childhood, so it stood to reason that drinking, smoking, and cussing would bring him a liberating sense of satisfaction. Thus, he had to have the quick smoke, the quick beer, after each game before he could even address the team. Jackson called the smoke and the drink getting his space. In his early years of coaching, that space came in the cramped bowels of Chicago Stadium, the old sandstone sarcophagus. In later years, he would have the comforts of fancy offices in the United Center and Staples Center. Wherever it was, his ritual was mostly the same: the smoke, the drink, the replaying of events, the sigh, the quiet releasing of all that pent-up emotion from the game. He needed that few minutes of space before he could even talk to the team, recalled an associate. After he talked to the team, he would need another few minutes of space before he could talk to the media. Jackson was always firm and direct in talking to his players after games, rarely raising his voice. And after tough losses, he could be especially consoling, commending their great effort, telling them it just wasn't meant to be. Later, he would spend hours reviewing the videotapes and picking apart the performance play by play, isolating exactly what had gone wrong and why. But his verdicts were hardly ever delivered with anything that resembled insistence or stridence. He is a hands-on manager, but with a different approach in every way, Bach said. It's deeply psychological. It's from the heart, except that he's able to separate it from his emotions. He's sort of a mystery to the players because he is not predictable. He doesn't overreact, or sometimes even react at all. Yet he has a firm hand. The great strength of Phil is that he is always very aware of what is happening. He could see things on the bench or in the locker room, but he never moved too quickly to fix things. He would only do that after he had thought about it. Then he would do just what was needed to calm the situation and the problem. The most important thing is that he has never sought their love. There are many coaches who want to be loved, who have to be loved, and go down in flames as a result of it. Pro athletes just aren't going to do that. They aren't going to give you that love if you seek it. Because he seemingly never sought it, Phil Jackson got what other coaches craved. He saw that on game nights, sitting there watching his players, first the Bulls, then the Lakers, execute his marvelously disciplined vision of the game. He would toast the results in private, the cigarette, the beer, the sigh, his communion in that mystic realm that only he understood. Chapter 1. Epiphanies. He ate the LSD for breakfast. It was one of those seamless Malibu mornings in mid-May 1973, just days after the New York Knickerbockers had defeated the Los Angeles Lakers 4-1 for the National Basketball Association championship. Phil Jackson was 27 years old, and although the 73 Knicks were the first pro championship team he had played for, he was hardly in the mood to celebrate. First, he had a philosophical problem. He viewed the journey itself as the real celebration. Just getting to the championship round and winning it was the joyous thing, not all that whooping and hollering and hugging with people you hardly knew or didn't know at all. He wanted no part of that, thank you. Then there were the injuries. He had performed well over the season, the best so far in his 6 years as a pro. He averaged 17 minutes of playing time per game, as well as 8.1 points, with better than 4 rebounds and an assist each outing, a superior contribution for a front-court reserve. He increased his scoring average to 8.7 points per game during the Knicks' title run, the second straight year he had done so. During New York's drive to the 1972 NBA Finals, Jackson had averaged 9.8 points and better than 5 rebounds, though they ultimately lost that 72 series to the Lakers. The Knicks returned to the championship series in 1973 with the goal of completing unfinished business. But Jackson suffered a leg injury during Game 3, and his mood darkened. He craved being an essential part of the team, and in his mind, the injury served to remove him from that essence. His pro career had brought a series of physical challenges, and this was yet another. In 1969, he had undergone spinal fusion surgery.